This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines. A source close to the Iranian nuclear negotiating team said that Iran will return to its JCPOA commitments only after the removal of all U.S. sanctions. Israeli forces shoot and kill a Palestinian man and wound his wife in the occupied West Bank. And the death toll from devastating floods and landslides in Indonesia and East Timor rises to 157 as rescuers try to find more than 70 people who are still missing. Thanks for joining us. Ahead of the upcoming Vienna talks on the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, a source close to the Iranian nuclear negotiating team has said that Tehran will not accept any result of the meeting but lifting of all sanctions. The Iranian source said the United States has no other option but to remove all sanctions in a verifiable manner. The source stressed that U.S. Special Representative for Iran, Robert Malley, will leave Vienna empty-handed on Tuesday if the outcome is anything but the lifting of all sanctions. The source said the U.S. response to unilateral commitment of Iran to the JCPOA should be unilateral lifting of sanctions. The source reiterated Iran's stance that it will reverse its retaliatory JCPOA steps only if the U.S. lifts all sanctions. The comments came after the U.S. said it expects the upcoming talks to be difficult.
We don't underestimate the scale of the challenges ahead. These are early days. We don't anticipate an early or immediate breakthrough, as these discussions we fully expect will be difficult.
The spokesperson added that the steps that Iran and the U.S. need to take to salvage the international agreements will be on the top of the agenda in Vienna. Koma Lesny is a correspondent who joins us from Vienna. Koma, so tell us what to expect, I guess, from this meeting and what not to expect. Am I correct to not expect an announcement that the U.S. may come out and say we're going to lift all sanctions? I mean, is that is something that's being discussed, that this meeting will perhaps reveal whether the U.S. will lift all sanctions or not?
Yes, of course. We do know, as you just said there, that the main purpose of this meeting that's taking place, not online, but in person in Vienna, in a few hours, is to bring back the U.S. into the JCPOA, to revive the deal, and for the U.S. to come back as far as Iran is concerned. This means the U.S. must lift all sanctions before Iran can take the steps to reverse the measures that it has taken when it comes to nuclear activities. The main discussion is about how this is going to happen. And the EU, which is coordinating this meeting between the JCPOA participants together from the one side and also coordinating in Vienna with the US, says that it believes that this is a serious opportunity to revive the JCPOA, and now the intention, as far as the EU has said, is to discuss what measures need to be taken when it comes to the sanctions lifting and the nuclear issues, because there are a lot of sanctions involved here, both the sanctions that were reimposed by President Trump, the sanctions that were previously lifted under the JCPOA, and also new sanctions introduced by Trump. We're hearing of something around 1,500 sanctions, and it looks like there's going to be a lot of expert discussions on which of these sanctions are the ones that are going to be lifted, how and when they're going to be lifted. But Iran has made it quite clear it's not going to go for a step-by-step approach. It's not going to accept a plan that would involve the Tehran taking measures first before the U.S. Lifts sanctions. Iran says that, first of all, it's not going to meet directly with the U.S. here in Vienna, The U.S. is here, as you said, the team led by Robert Malley, but they're going to meet separately with the other JCPOA participants and with the EU coordinator. Later today, there's going to be a joint commission session only with the JCPOA participants in which Iran will be present, and then we're expecting at least some statements coming from Iran or the other sides about any progress that's being made. But what we're hearing now is that it's going to be an issue of shuttle diplomacy, where the sides will speak with the U.S. separately, maybe convey the views expressed there to the Iranian side. But at the moment, bilateral meetings are underway here. We're hearing that Mr. Arakchi, who's representing the Iranian team, Iran's deputy foreign minister and key nuclear negotiator, has a tight schedule, has been engaged in various bilateral meetings with various JCPOA participants, which of course include Germany, Britain, France, Russia and China, and also with the EU coordinator, which is represented today in the EU team led by Mr. Enrique Mora, who is a deputy for Joseph Borrell, the EU High Commissioner.
Okay, let's see here. Again, the expectations on this meeting based on what's being said, it's such that, some are speculating that this will show whether the U.S. is going to lift all sanctions or not. Putting that aside, and I know we're not in the business of speculations, but could there be an impasse? Could a result come out that perhaps reaches a dead end? Can that be a result of this meeting that's happening today?
Look, what I'm hearing and what political observers seeing the situation on the ground are saying is that there are very serious efforts underway now to get this thing going, because time is of the essence. We know that there are going to be presidential elections in Iran soon. We know that the deal that Iran has had with the agency, allowing the agency to have access that was denied by the parliament, is only based on a temporary three-month basis. So they don't have a lot of time, and they know this. A lot of political observers are saying that the United States is indeed serious. It's not just the words, but it says that it does want to come back to the JCPOA. The issue now is how this is going to happen. And over the past months and weeks, it hasn't been as serious as it has at this stage, because it is at a stage where it has required an in-person meeting in Vienna. This is seen as a positive sign. And the United States itself has said that although the way ahead is difficult and there are going to be some difficult discussions, but that they're on the right track. And the EU as well, it has seen this as a positive issue. As the United States officials have said, maybe they're not expecting immediately after this meeting a breakthrough, but it looks like that this is the beginning of a very serious attempt to resolve the issue. We'll have to see if this can actually happen. We are hearing that this meeting could continue beyond today for the next few days. We still don't know. Or maybe at the expert level, discussions will continue over the next week. So we'll see how serious it is going to get. And we'll get, I think, an idea of that once the Joint Commission meeting ends and statements are made.
Okay, and when do we expect this meeting to take place?
We're expecting it as far as I know, though it's not been officially announced, in a few hours, maybe after midday here in Vienna, or somewhere around 2 to 3 p.m. So in a few hours from now, because before the official meeting, there's a lot of discussions taking place at the bilateral level.
Okay, I'm sure we'll be speaking soon. Thank you very much for that. We appreciate it, Homa. Homa Lesky there from Vienna. Moving on. Iran has received the first shipment of COVID-19 vaccine by the World Health Organization's mechanism COVAX. The Iranian Health Ministry says the consignment contains more than 700,000 doses of the Oxford AstraZeneca jab produced in South Korea. The ministry says 3.6 million other doses will be sent to Iran under COVAX by the end of May. Iran has purchased nearly 17 million doses of COVID vaccine for its inoculation campaign. The doses also include those made in Russia, China, and in India. Iran is also working on producing its own COVID vaccines to ease shortages it blames on financial problems caused by U.S. sanctions. Palestinian children continue to pay a heavy price of Israeli inhumane practices as they mark Palestinian Child Day. Israeli forces have killed and maimed thousands of Palestinian children in recent years and continue to violate their rights on a daily basis. Ashraf Shannon brings us more.
Palestinian children continue to suffer due to Israel's inhumane practices as they mark Palestinian Child Day. Israeli forces have killed and injured thousands of Palestinian children over the past decade under the watchful eye of the international community. Last year alone, Israeli forces killed 9 Palestinian children. During a press conference marking the annual event, Palestinians demanded that Israeli forces be held accountable for their crimes against Palestinian children.
Israeli soldiers are acting with impunity because they feel that they will not be prosecuted for their crimes. Such policies have encouraged Israeli soldiers to violate our rights. The international community must take concrete steps to prosecute those Israeli soldiers who kill and maim us on a daily basis.
Scores of Palestinian children lost their lives during the Great March of Return peaceful rallies due to Israel's use of excessive force against peaceful protesters. According to human rights organizations, the Israeli attacks on Palestinian children were systematic.
As we mark Palestinian Child Day, Israel continues to commit grave violations against Palestinian children, including wounding them and killing them. Israel also violates the social, economic, and cultural rights. The Israeli blockade has negatively affected all aspects of life for Palestinian children in the Gaza Strip.
Since 2008, the Israeli regime waged 3 wars on the Gaza Strip, killing and maiming thousands of children. During Israel's 2014 war on Gaza, Israeli forces killed over 2,200 Gazans, including hundreds of children.
The Zionist enemy violates the rights of Palestinian children to live. They have bombed the homes where Palestinian children live and have deprived them from receiving proper education and health care. Palestinian children are even deprived from the right of movement.
Palestinian Child Day highlights the ongoing plight of those born under Israeli occupation and blockade.
Human rights groups have long accused the Israeli regime of deliberately targeting Palestinian children. This comes amid the failure of the international community to hold Tel Aviv accountable for its crimes. Ashraf Shannon, Gaza.
A Palestinian man has been shot dead by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank. According to the Palestinian Health Ministry, the motorist died after sustaining head wounds from live fire. His wife suffered bullet wounds to her back. The fatal shooting happened in the town of Bir Nabala at dawn as the couple were traveling in their car. The Palestinian man was a member of the Bedouin community. Our correspondent Mona Kandil earlier joined us from Ramallah and gave details about the latest fatal shooting in the occupied West Bank.
The soldiers at the checkpoint ordered the Palestinian martyr Osama Mansour, 42 years old, to stop his vehicle, and he stopped his vehicle. He spoke to the soldiers. However, then they claimed that he speeded his vehicle towards another group of Israeli soldiers at the end of the street, according to the claims of the Israeli soldiers. This is why the troops at the checkpoint who stopped him opened fire. They shot him at the head and also shot his wife in the back. He succumbed to his injuries. His wife was transferred to one of the Palestinian hospitals in the city of Ramallah. According to the doctors, the wife said that he stopped his vehicle and spoke to the soldiers. And then the soldiers ordered him that he can complete his way where he was returning back to his home in the village of Bidu. But the Israelis claimed that he tried to carry out an anti-Israeli operation or to hit Israeli soldiers there.
A prominent rights group has warned against the attack on the freedom of expression and a rise in authoritarianism in Jordan amid a political turmoil in the kingdom. Human Rights Watch says that a wave of arrests in Jordan over an alleged plot against the ruling family is a testimony of a diminishing space for the freedom of expression and political dialogue. The HRW warning comes after Amman accused former Crown Prince Hamza bin Hussein of involvement in a conspiracy to destabilize the kingdom's security. The prince, who is the king's half-brother, was placed under house arrest, while his bodyguards and at least 16 others were detained. On Monday, Hamza, however, signed a letter declaring his support for the king. That's a day after, in a video recording, he denounced the ruling system as corrupt. Author of Middle East expert Kevin Barrett says the Jordanian government, under U.S. influence, is repressing the freedom of expression in the country.
Well, there's not a whole lot of freedom of expression in Jordan, as we all know. All of the mosques in Jordan, for example, are controlled by the government, and the government is indirectly controlled by the U.S. Embassy for the most part. So this whole issue of freedom of expression in Jordan is actually kind of a red herring. I think the real issue here is what's going on with this alleged coup attempt. And I think that the information offered by Richard Silverstein at his Tikkun Olam blog is probably correct. He says that there was indeed a coup attempt in which Hamza bin Hussein, the ex-crown prince, attempted to overthrow King Abdullah with the help of Israel and Saudi Arabia, and indeed that an Israeli Mossad asset named Roy Shapochnik was part of this plot. And Shapochnik is apparently, Jordan says he's ex-Mossad, but he's actually current Mossad. He's a Sayanem, and the Sayanem are, of course, the Mossad's little helpers scattered all over the world. So it looks like the Saudis and Israelis together wanted to install a more pliable regime in Jordan.
The death toll from flash floods and landslides in Indonesia and neighboring East Timor has surged past 150. Except for 27, the rest of the deaths have occurred in Indonesia. Dozens remain missing there. Officials say thousands of people have fled to shelters after tropical cyclone Saroja battered the Southeast Asian nations on Sunday. Homes, as well as hospitals and bridges, have been damaged or destroyed. A rescue operation is underway, but the efforts are hampered by bad weather conditions. More heavy rains are expected in the coming days. India has registered nearly 97,000 new coronavirus infections in the past 24 hours. According to data by the Health Ministry, India's total case number is now 12.7 million. That is the third highest in the world, after the U.S. and Brazil. India's total deaths from the pandemic have passed 165,000 after more than 440 new fatalities were recorded. India's daily infections have risen about 12-fold since hitting a multi-month low in early February. That is when most restrictions were eased. The country has also launched a vaccination program since mid-January. China says one of its aircraft carrier groups is exercising near Taiwan as part of routine drills there. China's Navy said similar exercises will be conducted on a regular basis in the future. It said the aim is to enhance China's capability to safeguard national sovereignty, safety, and development interests. Drills come as tensions remain high between China and Taiwan that is supported by the U.S. Washington has pushed ahead with selling arms to Taipei despite strong opposition from Beijing. China has also been angry at U.S. military movements near Taiwan. Beijing considers the island as part of its territory. We talked to China strategist Andrew Loing. He says that Beijing is making clear that Taiwan is a red line issue that no one should overstep.
What China is trying to demonstrate to the United States that China's national sovereignty and also national security cannot change merely because of U.S. sanctions. And sanctions don't work. And of course, China is going to make this a regular kind of feature, a new normal, as it were. To safeguard this passage through the Taiwan Strait and also to prevent Taiwan from verging on declaring independence, because that would be the absolute, absolute red line. Don't forget there is a law enacted on the mainland that in case that there is any overt and de facto independence, then obviously the China would deploy this weaponry over the Taiwan Strait to prevent that from happening. But let's make no mistake. If there's a war on Taiwan, it's not just in the South China Sea. It's going to be a war between the United States and China, and involving possibly some of the U.S. allies like Japan. And then it's not just a regional war, because the war could escalate into a global nuclear war.
And that does it for World News. It's bye-bye for now.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
As a reminder, dear listeners, we said in our last program that the late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, highly respected the source of emulation, Grand Ayatollah Hossein Boujardi, and never allowed anyone to disrespect him, as he was the head of the seminaries in the 1950s. Today we are going to dwell upon Imam Khomeini's stance towards Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Mohsen Hakim, who was a great source of emulation in Iraq. Please stay with us. Grand Grand Ayatollah said Mohsen Hakim was one of the great sources of emulation some 60 years ago. He was born in a family of ulama and religious scholars, and his father, Sayyid Mahdi Hakim, was one of the great jurisprudents in Najaf. After the demise of Grand Ayatollah Naini, some of his emulators referred to Grand Ayatollah Hakim. Later on, after the demise of Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Abul Hassan Isfahani, Grand Ayatollah Hakim became famous as one of the leading jurisprudents and a source of emulation. Then, after the passing away of Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi, Grand Ayatollah Hakim became more famous. In addition to writing several books, he made great effort to organize seminaries and played a major role in prevention of infiltration of communism in Iraq. After the coup d'etat of Abdul Karim Qasim in Iraq and his coming to power in 1958, the ground was prepared for propagation of communism and the passage of laws incompatible with Islamic tenets and principles. Under such circumstances, Grand Ayatollah Hakim officially protested against the measure and urged religious scholars or ulama and preachers to make people aware of the anti-religious nature of these new legislations. Moreover, he issued two fatwas or religious edicts which prohibited joining the Communist Party. These religious edicts or fatwas caused other ulama in the city of Najaf to issue similar fatwas, forcing the tyrant Abdul Karim Qasim to retreat and apologize. Grand Ayatollah Hakim carried out good political activities to defend the Iraqi and the Iranian peoples, but he had differences with Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, in the way of political struggles against the ruling system in the two countries. He protested against jailing and torturing of opponents by the government of Abdus Salam Aref and the sectarian and discriminatory policies at the time by the Iraqi Ba'athist regime. He even issued a fatwa during the repression of the Kurds in Iraq by RF, which called it illegitimate to enter war against the Kurds. The religious edict or fatwa prevented the killing of Iraqi Kurds. Grand Ayatollah Hakim even called on all Muslims to stand firm against the occupation of Palestine by the Zionist regime of Israel. Furthermore, in the incident of the burning of the Holy Al-Aqsa Mosque in the city of Al-Quds in 1969, he issued a statement to remind Muslims of their religious and historical responsibilities and duties against the Zionists. As for some of the developments in Iran, such as the bloodshed at the Fazir school in Qom and the massacring of thousands of innocent people on 5th of June 1963 by the bloodthirsty Pahlavi regime, Grand Ayatollah Hakim expressed his opposition. Yet his approach was different from that of Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul. He didn't agree with nationwide uprising against the regimes in Iran and Iraq, and he was concerned about repetition of the bloody repression of the Iraqi people in the 1920s. Since his arrival in the city of Najaf, Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, tried to inform Grand Ayatollah Hakim of Iran's political developments, especially the oppressive and unjust rule of the Pahlavi regime. One of the current sources of emulation, Grand Ayatollah Nuri Hamedani, narrates an account on this issue. Grand Ayatollah Nuri Hamedani says, on the advent of Imam Khomeini's arrival in Najaf, one night he paid a visit to Grand Ayatollah Hakim. Many students accompanied the Imam. The Imam proposed to Grand Ayatollah Hakim to take a trip to Iran to see Iran's conditions closely and not to be content with reports from Iran. Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, always urged Grand Ayatollah Hakim to be a leader in the struggles against the despotic regimes in both Iran and Iraq. Hujjatul Islam Murtaza Sadeghi Tehrani says in this regard, although Imam Khomeini was a prominent scholar amongst religious scholars and ulama, and used to behave humbly before late Grand Ayatollah Hakim to inform him of developments in Iran, he would say to Grand Ayatollah Hakim, I am one of your followers and among those who obey your commands. If you order, we will obey. If you command, we will act. How do you think that you have no one to obey you whilst I am one of them? As it was said earlier, there were differences between Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, and Grand Ayatollah Hakim, particularly with regards to the killing of ulama and students at the Fazir school in Qom. After the savage assault by the Pahlavi regime's military against the Fazir school, Grand Ayatollah Hakim asked the Iranian religious scholars to migrate to Iraq. But the revolutionary ulama, especially Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, opposed this proposal. Nevertheless, the Imam never allowed anyone to disrespect Grand Ayatollah Hakim. It is narrated that once an Iranian student in the city of Najaf said something against Grand Ayatollah Hakim. Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, immediately protested against the move and reprimanded the student.
The debate.
It's called vaccine nationalism. What is it? In short, the hoarding up of COVID-19 vaccines. And who is guilty? Well, Western and developed nations like the US and the UK. Aside from the obvious reasons, why are they doing this, or should the question be, why are they allowed to do this, while other countries barely have enough, if any? As if the pandemic was not enough, now this is added to the COVID-19 mix to be covered in this edition of the debate.
How can you end a pandemic? Pandemics are global by definition. Unless vaccines are administered to all of the world's 8 billion inhabitants, COVID-19 is likely to live among us for a while. And what if some countries stockpile vaccines and refuse to share them with others? The pandemic will persist for the next few years, if not decades. That's the simple logic the UN chief has been trying to promote for months. This week, Antonio Guterres once again warned wealthy countries against COVID-19 vaccine nationalism and hoarding. The UN chief argued that it is not the best strategy to vaccinate everybody in one country before those most vulnerable are not vaccinated in the global south. He said it then becomes a danger even for the populations that have been vaccinated. Analysts say some wealthy countries are not only stockpiling vaccines, but using the global crisis as an opportunity to advance their positions.
These wealthy countries that would have to play a key role in making accessible medicine for any reason, not just COVID-19, we can see that they're not acting in good faith. I think it goes beyond nationalism. I think they saw an opportunity here, a global crisis, to take advantage of it to advance their own positions.
According to researchers at Duke's Global Health Innovation Center, high and upper middle-income nations, which represent one-fifth of the world's population, have bought around 6 billion doses. This is why low and lower middle-income countries have secured only around 2.6 billion. This includes 1.1 billion doses for the UN-backed COVAX program. So far, nearly 650 million doses of COVID-19 vaccines have been administered to people around the world. Figures show over 60% has been administered in high-income countries, which account for only 16% of the world's population. This is while dozens of countries are yet to receive a single jab. Over 131 million people have contracted a deadly respiratory disease across the globe, more than 2.8 million of whom have lost their lives. How many more casualties are needed for the wealthy countries to stop hoarding vaccines and ensure fairness in vaccine distribution across the globe? Equal vaccine access for all countries will help end this crisis.
Our guest joining us for this edition of the debate, former UN Special Rapporteur Alfred de Zayas, joins us from Geneva. We also have author and international human rights lawyer Daniel Kobalik, who joins us from Pittsburgh. I'd like to welcome you both. Alfred de Zayas, let me first start with you. This warning has come, and a variety of outlets, I'm going to mention the United Nations, where the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has criticized, quote, many examples of vaccine nationalism and vaccine hoarding, as well as side deals, as he said, with COVID-19 vaccine manufacturers, in which he said it undermines access to all the people in the world. Tell us exactly what is going on.
Well, let's start with fundamentals. The right to health is not a commodity. Vaccines are, shall we say, our human right. And the Covenant on Economics and Cultural Rights stresses that in several general comments. Not only Secretary General Antonio Guterres, but also the High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, has said that. Also the United Nations Rapporteur on the Right to Health, Mokokanya. Also the Special Rapporteur on Unilateral Coercive Measures, Alena Dohan, has said that. I have said that in several statements that I've made to press services. It's important to put the focus on the coordination activity of the World Health Organization. Dr. Tedros Ghebreyesus, already beginning of this year, spoke of a catastrophic moral failure, and he issued a declaration on vaccine equity. Yesterday in the Vatican, during the Easter Day blessing, Pope Francis, in his Urbi and Orbi statement, specifically focused on vaccine equity and the necessity to ensure the distribution of vaccine. There are countries that do not have even their first vaccine, including Timor-Este, Sierra Leone, Yemen, etc. It is clearly un-Christian and it is immoral and unethical to hoard these vaccines. And what makes it even more immoral is that countries like the United States, Canada, United Kingdom, and many European countries maintain economic sanctions against countries, thereby making it practically impossible for these countries to obtain vaccines, to purchase vaccines, to produce vaccines, to improve their chances of survival, to improve their hospital infrastructures, etc. So there's a huge complex of human rights violations, which in my opinion should be sent up to the International Court of Justice through a resolution of the General Assembly under Article 96 of the UN Charter, requesting an advisory opinion saying this entails crimes against humanity. And the crimes against humanity are being committed deliberately by the West.
Okay, this is very interesting. Daniel Kobalik, didn't have that on the lineup of questions that I had, and I'm glad you have Alfred de Zayas talk about that. So let me ask your for your insight on this. I mean, this definitely is another branch of this whole debacle that's, in a sense, taking place, where you have countries that are hoarding the vaccines, like the U.S., U.K., France, and at the same time, they have exercised sanctions, in particular the U.S., against countries that can't get the vaccine into their own. For their own population, which, according to Alfred de Zayas, they should be taking up to the ICC. So that's a grave violation of human rights, to say the least.
Yes, well, and I agree with Dr. Desais on this issue, and I'll see him and raise him. Not only is the West hoarding the vaccines from countries who are being sanctioned by the West, of course, the West is hoarding it from countries they're actively at war with, including Yemen, which Dr. Desais mentioned, which is now either on the verge of famine or fully in famine right now because of the U.S.-backed Saudi war there that's continued since 2015. Afghanistan is another example, of course. Syria, another example. Libya, you know, where the West has either actively at war with those countries or recently at war has left those countries devastated and still is not providing vaccines for those countries. To me, this is really a crime against humanity, if not even genocidal. And then you look at a case like Cuba, where Cuba has several vaccines right now that it is testing. It probably would already have these vaccines online, which it would freely share with other third world countries, as we know that's what Cuba does. But the sanctions have slowed Cuba down greatly. Again, not from only being able to have a vaccine for its own people, but from being able to develop it in aid of other countries. So we see human rights violations, crimes against humanity, compounded on each other when we talk about this issue.
Professor Zayas, one of the words that stuck out in this array of facts regarding the hoarding was the word concessions. And I'm going to put this into context for you, where there are indications, as this one report said, that the G7 countries, well, they're listening with the leaders of France, the UK, and the US, and they are suggesting that they're going to make some concessions on vaccines during this meeting which took place, hosted by the UK. I mean, I'm not too sure. When I see that word, it's as if they're saying, okay, we'll let some countries have some of the doses that we have, like the US, which even though they have 600 million doses, they may have more at this point, they have not followed through on their concessions, quote unquote. That just, in a sense, bothers the mind to think that they're willing to save lives, possibly, by saying that. That's the impression, at least, that it gives off.
Of course, and that's what it is. The problem is privatization of health. I mean, unless you understand health as a global public good, you understand that there is a human right to health. And most of these countries are state bodies to the Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights that actually stipulate the right to health. That means that all of these countries are actually violating the provisions of the Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. There's also the right to international solidarity. My colleague Virginia Dandan from the Philippines, rapporteur on solidarity, issued a declaration on the right to international solidarity. Needless to say, it was boycotted by the United States and boycotted by the European Union. Same thing happened recently in the Human Rights Council last week as the resolution were adopted. There was a resolution which specifically condemned the practice of imposing economic sanctions, in particular now during the pandemic. This was adopted by 30 votes in favor, 15 votes against, and who were among the 15? The European Union countries. Now, how can you, on the one side, argue, advocate civil and political rights, and then so completely ignore economic, social, and cultural rights? But it's not just economic rights. The right to life belongs in the category of civil and political. So actually, what we're dealing with here is a major violation of the right to life through a violation of the right to health. I come back to my proposal. This must come up before the International Court of Justice, because if a rapporteur like me, or Duhan, or Motokai, condemn this kind of practices, this kind of sanctions, this kind of blackmail, that's very fine and good. But you need the highest judicial instance of the United Nations to say this entails a crime against humanity. You also have to send it to the International Criminal Court. They have competence to declare it a crime against humanity.
Sure. Well, the depth of this is still being explored as to what can be done when you take a look at, for example, this Duke University, whose researcher has said, who has been analyzing the deals, said that countries with deals for the COVID vaccine have priority manufacturing slots for this year, 2021, which means that even if other countries make purchases now, they may have to wait months or even a year for the delivery. And, well, as a result, you have high-income countries who have 16% of the world's population but currently hold 60% of the vaccine doses that have been purchased. So, Daniel Kovalik, that leaves basically this means money talks. And this means that these countries that don't have the money may not be getting the vaccine anytime soon. There needs to be something done here. There needs to be some type of action, as our guest there mentioned quite rightly, so maybe through the UN or then eventually the ICC. How do you think this can be at least somewhat controlled for fair distribution?
Well, I totally agree with my colleague, Dr. Desais, that this is a matter for the ICJ and the ICC. It's hard to think of a greater crime than what is happening right now with, as you say, this hoarding of vaccines that are being made largely for profit, huge profit, while, again, the lion's share of the world's population goes without. You know, and the other thing I question is, what will the world look like if this is not ameliorated? You're going to have only the northern hemisphere that has the vaccines. The southern hemisphere will be left largely without it. What will be done with those people? You're going to have a giant gated community in the West, and that's very concerning. Obviously, this will lead to more human rights abuses, both under the covenant on political rights and the covenant on economic, social, and cultural rights, as Dr. Desais says. Something needs to be done immediately. I agree, it has to happen to the United Nations, and it has to happen to the General Assembly, because, of course, the Security Council is locked up by the veto power of countries like the United States and the UK, who probably would try to stop any affirmative action from happening to help the Global South. So it does have to happen to the General Assembly, and I'm glad Dr. Desais also mentioned the Pope's words on Easter Sunday, which I think were very important, and which I hope Christians and Christian nations abide by and listen to and heed, because otherwise we're looking at a dystopic world, very much in the near future.
Well, Afra Desais, I have to mention this also. I mean, we could talk about this aspect, which is becoming kind of like shock revelations. For example, South Africa, why does it have to pay twice as much for vaccines as European countries? Why has Africa, home to 1.3 billion people, been allocated just 300 million doses? So that's another shock statistic there. But I think the motion for something to be done is something that perhaps you in your capacity as a former UN Special Rapporteur you made your suggestions already, but really what can be done? I mean, there needs to be, before there's going to be some kind of social breakout when the world becomes lopsided with just G7 countries getting vaccines and the rest of the world lagging behind, losing their innocent population. So from here on, what can be done?
Well, the Secretary General has been sensitized, and he's been speaking about it, not now, but already in 2020. Tedros Ghebreyesus, the Director General of the World Health Organization, has been speaking about this and has invoked the international health regulations. And obviously, the High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, the Rapporteur on the Right to Health, the Rapporteur on Sanctions, etc. But words will not make it happen. The General Assembly has to have an emergency session. I would like to call for an emergency session of the General Assembly to elevate these issues to the International Court of Justice for an advisory opinion that will finally say that a vaccine and the right to health is not a commodity. And this must be ensured by the international community. That is why the United Nations was created, for multilateralism, for cooperation, for international solidarity. And me, as a practicing Catholic, I consider that the actions of many Western countries that call themselves Christian entail what we term in Catholic parlance mortal sin. We are directly responsible for the deaths of countless people in the third world because we make it nearly impossible for them to obtain the vaccine.
Right.
So this is not only a legal question, it's an ethical question, it's a moral question.
Indeed. We're going to have to unfortunately leave it there. Thank you very much. Former UN Special Rapporteur Alfred Desaias there from Geneva, thank you for your thoughts there. And author and international human rights lawyer Daniel Kovalik, thank you so much from Pittsburgh. That does it for this edition of The Debate. From Mikko Vitale, my entire team, it's goodbye until next time.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali عليه الصلاة والسلام, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program's To My Brother, and I'm your host, Mehdi. We're talking about the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
تبقى عيني بدمع مشتاقيا قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبيب لها ولا راغي.
What non-Muslims say about Ali, the first successor of Prophet Muhammad? Edward Gibbon, 1737 to 1794, considered the greatest British historian of his time, in his book, The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, says the following about Imam Ali. The zeal and virtue of Ali were never outstripped by any recent proselyte. He united the qualifications of a poet, a soldier, and a saint. His wisdom still breathes in a collection of moral and religious sayings, and every antagonist in the combats of the tongue or of the sword was subdued by his elders.